KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
You're tuned into KAEB 91.9 FM. All music, all the time.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, April 14th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Uro.
And this week, we're going to be taking the grand tour talking about opossum pipefish, Micropus lineatus.
We are very pleased to welcome fish biologist Eddie Perry from our Peninsular Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. So great to see you, Eddie. So happy you can join us to talk about this very cool fish.
Nice to see you, too. Really excited to talk about the opossum pipefish.
Okay, so first things first, this fish has a very interesting name, and I'm sure folks listening are curious what it looks like. So can you pretend that Guy and I are there in Florida with you? We're seeing one of these fish. Maybe we've caught one. Just give us an idea of what it looks like.
Oh, that's great. So if I was going to give you an idea of what an opossum pipefish looks like, I would tell you, have you ever held a wet stick in your hand? Because if so,
yeah.
that's majority of what possum pipefish looks like. And, you know, that's a strategy. They camouflage well with their environment. Truly, they're a really remarkable fish. If you don't know what a pipefish is a relative of a seahorse, like a straightened out little seahorse. It has a long snout, a straight, long body. The opossum pipefish is the ancestral pipefish to all seahorses and pipefishes. They go back 50 million years. It's like a living fossil type of a fish. Yeah, I know. The opossum pipefish, what we're talking about today, is a relatively large pipefish. Get up to be about 7.5 inches long. I would say about the length and thickness of a pencil, unsharpened.
They have unsharpened.
Unsharpened. Well, you know, once you sharpen it, you never know. But they have a long dorsal fin, and the males have a pouch on their belly. Because like all other seahorse and pipefish, the males carry the eggs. Now, seeing as how this is pipefish found in North America, I imagine it got its name from the only marsupial known to inhabit our land, the possum, without the O, as you like to say it. But they're really cool little fish. They're tiny. We catch them from 3 inches up to about 7. And like I said, it kind of feels like you're picking up a little wet stick, and then you go, oh, crap, it's actually a fish.
Mm-hmm. Guy's going to jab you here and say you could probably draw this one better than you do your seahorse since they're straight.
Yeah, that's probably true. I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm a great illustrator by any means. You've got a pretty cool looking behind you. Is that a sketch or is that a photo that you got there, Eddie?
Behind me, this is a sketch. This sketch was made by Dr. Grant Gilmore. He's one of the most foremost people in our area. I live and work in Vero Beach, Florida, which is on the Atlantic coast of the state, about half the way down. And where I live, we're directly right on the Indian River Lagoon, which is considered the most biodiverse estuary in North America, with over 700 species of fish that spend all or part of their life here.
Wow. I'm kind of curious. So you mentioned the Indian River Lagoon. What's that habitat like? When I think about pipefishes or seahorses, usually I'm thinking marine fish. Now, you're with Fish and Wildlife Service. That's kind of primarily freshwater. So what is this habitat like, and what is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's interest in it?
Well, that's great, because like you said, when people think about pipefish and seahorses, you probably think of an aquarium, maybe corals, something really cool and fancy, even though sea dragons, those things are freaking amazing. I think there's something like 200 to 250 species of pipefish on the planet, and they are everywhere. Even up there in Alaska, Katrina, you have a bay pipefish that lives in the Alaskan Bay. But anyways, out of those 200, whatever, 17 or 20 of them are freshwater fish. So our pipefish that we're talking about here is a freshwater fish. Now, the Indian River Lagoon goes along the eastern coast of the state of Florida, approximately 150, 160 miles long. It covers about a quarter of the state. And nowadays, there's a number of inlets that connect this lagoon to the ocean. But before we came and dug these inlets, the old timers here would say they could dip a cup in the north end of the lagoon and drink it. It was fresh water. So our pipefish have lived here. They've changed here. They've adapted here. And they do live a lifestyle that is partly in the ocean and in the fresh water. They don't need to, but they do. And we'll get into that when we talk about how they breed and whatnot. But this is a freshwater fish, right? And South Florida used to be a place with tropical rivers, the St. Sebastian River, the Port St. Lucie River, and the Loxahatchee River, which still exists, but there was all little tributaries of freshwater wetlands that have become channelized, turned into canals and ditches, but these fish don't recognize that. So what we're seeing is we have a population of these really impressive freshwater fish. They live in little canals down in Florida where people are really worried about catching tarpon and snook, and they don't really draw the interest. You know, we talk a lot about like that charismatic megafauna that's going to like be the poster child for the species that we save. This is not it to most people. But to me, you know, weird fish person, this is like the coolest thing that ever was. These fish were found in Florida in 1955 in the mouth of the St. Johns River, never collected up that way again, and are only found reproducing populations in the freshwater tributaries to the Indian River Lagoon. So the only place in North America you can find these fishes here in Florida, in a very small geographic region with a lot of development, a lot of channels, a lot of ditches, digging, dredging, herbicides, you know how it goes. So our concern is that we've seen these fish numbers deplete over the years. There's a number of scientists. I mentioned Dr. Grant Gilmore, who drew this beautiful sketch behind me, who have been working on these fish since the 60s and the 70s. And those people have brought to our attention the need to highlight and to look into these fish. A lot of protections, red listing, and these types of things that would happen for other species that are bigger and people know about aren't going to happen for these pipefish until more is known about them. So we started digging in and looking into it. We are U.S. Fish and Wildlife in Florida. Like, we should be working on our native fish. And we are focused on freshwater fisheries. And these fish are the poster child we chose. You know, they are our charismatic mini fauna that we chose to represent a number of fish, freshwater gobies, the grunts, the croakers, the type of fish that all evolved in the same land with these fish, similar life histories, life strategies. But this one is the one that stands out because of how unique, how special it is, the lineage, just everything about it is so cool to me. The more and more I know, the cooler and cooler this thing gets. Like if it was if this thing was 6 feet long, it would rule the earth.
And you're really selling it, Eddie. What's your big fish down there? I'm thinking we need to speed up to this one. That sounds awesome.
It's got
to
be the Florida bass. I'm throwing a guess out there. I don't know. I love Florida largemouth bass like everyone else. Recently changed the name to the Florida bass. But as I explained before, I'm the little weird fish junkie. So for me, the type of fish that I like to look for and that I think are really important to save because they're forgotten, because they don't have a voice of their own, because they can't speak up like the Florida bass that everyone wants to catch and angle for, those are the ones I feel need us more than anybody. So our state fish should be the possum pipefish, but it ain't.
Is this mini fauna a new thing since you've been down in Florida?
No, when I started my fisheries career, I gravitated immediately towards the weird little things. I think I've always loved that. When you're looking for the weird little mini fish, you feel like you're exploring and you never know what the heck you're going to find. And you're in a ditch, a canal behind a dump, you know, moving a garbage bag, flipping rocks. So it's like that idea of exploring, finding this little thing that maybe you've never seen before and then working your way to figure out what it is. For me, that's the best. But my favorite mini fish in New York was the Northern Hog Choker. It's a small freshwater sole. They're amazing little fish. Migrate up the Hudson River. If there wasn't a dam most of the way up, they'd probably be up in the Adirondacks. But it spans the whole seaboard. We have them down here in Florida. The Northern Hog Choker was something that really excited me then. I got into sticklebacks and tessellated Johnny Darters and all the little man toms and tadpole man toms and things that we could find up there really got me excited. When I went to Michigan, it was not much different. And now down here in Florida, really just focusing on pushing hard and fighting for these little fish.
That's awesome. I like that idea of kind of exploring. And I'm curious from that standpoint, like if you were to kind of step into the life of one of these fish, what would its life course be like? What's it doing? Its life history.
It's got a really amazing life history because, like I said before, a part of its life history can doesn't necessarily need to, but is connected to the open ocean. A similar life strategy to other fish or prawns that live in our water body, like macrobrachium, freshwater prawns, and a lot of the gobies, they will mate in freshwater. These guys have this really cool mating dance. You can imagine like those Olympic ribbon spinning people, but I picture like two ribbons spinning in unison with each other. And they make this clicking sound. And we know this from studies done in laboratories in aquarium tanks. But a little cool sidebar is, how did they find that out, that they were making this clicking sound? Well, one of the original researchers who was working on the native fish of our area stumbled upon the pipefish and was collecting them in numbers and had, you know, up to 20, 25, 30 of these things in the net and was running out of room to hold them. So he put one of them in his mouth, and while in his mouth, hanging out half, probably like a little straw or something in his mouth, he felt and heard the clicking sound it was making. Maybe it thought it was spawning with him. I don't know. But that was like, oh, what it would be to be an old time fish biologist. I'm not saying I never tried, but anyways, they do this really cool clicking sound. If you look at the picture behind me, I know that people listening won't be able to see it, but they have a really amazing coloration, especially when breeding. So if I'm going to step into the life of one of these fish, it's probably during the breeding season, because that's when I'm the most excited, as this guy behind me, and the most colored up. So it's very distinctive color. In the breeding adults, they get these bands in the upper snout, and bands are throughout their body like red lines with black lines in between. The body, the whole body becomes this burnt sienna brown. I love how the old timers described it as burnt sienna, and not just brown. You know, burnt sienna brown, possibly because of their life in these tannic waters, they would blend in really well. They get a silver stripe down their body, and then their caudal tail, it's a little flag. This caudal tail turns bright red as well. The females also get colored. There's not enough real research into seeing the real different distinctions in color, but the picture behind you, Katrina, is a female. The females don't get as colored up, and this could be for spawning practices, purposes, also for individual identification. Because like most seahorses, also pipefish, they're believed to be monogamous. And now the studies that we have in our area with these seahorses, they follow through that. Now that's not going to say that one female might not sneak by and slide a couple eggs in a pouch without looking, but they pair with their same mate for their life, which is crazy to think that these little guys do that. Well, anyways.
Well, how long is their life?
Well, their life is not as long as you would imagine, and we don't necessarily know exactly how long they may live. But if this fish is going to live for, say, 10 years, that's a pretty long time for a small fish. Back in the day, Dr. Gilmore was collecting a mating pair every about 100 yards in every stream bank. And when we do collect them, you collect them in twos. It's a male and a female, a male and a female. It's almost all the time you're collecting them in twos. So life history, they're going to do their little dance. The female is going to deposit some eggs in the male's pouch. Now, something cool about these pipefish is they're the only North American pipefish that's pouch is on its chest. It's a thoracic pouch. All other, but not all, but the other type of pipefish would have a pouch on its tail. Now, this chest pouch or belly pouch is a remnant of the ancestral pipefishes. So this is one of those features that this pipefish has that hasn't changed from the originals. Now, having discussions on why would they change from having a chest pouch to a tail pouch, what would kind of benefit them? I was told to do a PhD on that. But anyways, they have a really big chest pouch, and the males hold the eggs in a single layer along their pouch so that they can constantly feed them, nurture them, and nourish them, as opposed to being in multiple layers where there would have to be movement, exchange, to have them, you know, part of the body. And for about 5 to 8 days, they'll have the eggs in their pouch, and then they'll get ready to release. So the males and the females spawning season in Florida is during our wet season. Now, for those of you who don't live in Florida, you may think that there's a spring, winter, summer, and fall, but no, my friend, there is not. There's a wet season and a dry season for us. And the wet season goes about May to November. Dry season is the winter, November-ish through April. And the wet season is characterized with wet weather. So we'll have high flows, tropical storms. And these high flows and tropical storms are what signal the pipefish to spawn and release their larva. The male will release the larva. And something really cool before we get to the larva is the female will then slip in a couple more eggs. And they could do this 2 to 3 times. Like, you thought you were done. They could do it like 2 to 3 times. So not only does this ensure success in spawning, but also it could allow for success during a random event, a bad water quality event. The first spawn hatch of larva might not have made it, but we got another one coming. And we got another one. Oh, this is like DJ Khaled, another one, you know? So these guys would then have a cloud of larva floating downstream, which to our current Indian River Lagoon would be in the lagoon, which is now saltwater, and out inlet into the ocean. Now, these pipefish, unlike some other pipefishes, hold a lot of eggs at a time. They can be found to have up to 1,000 eggs per batch, which is a lot compared to some of the other smaller pipefish, might be in the 20s or 30s. So then those juvenile are going to drift out to sea. And in some cases, they do live in landlocked freshwater populations. Now, that's not the rule, you know, but in this case, they're going to drift out to sea, and they're found among sargassum mats. So you might say, what is sargassum? Sargassum is a brown macroalgae with little floating little air bubbles, and it's all over our ocean around here. I'm pretty sure it's everywhere in the tropical oceans around the world, but we get large mats of it coming from Sargasso Sea, the Bermuda Triangle, dun, 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 you know the deal. And they'll live in those sargassum mats. We don't know how long until they become juveniles, about 2 to 3 inches, and then they'll work their way back into the freshwater. It's also important to note, you might think of these pipefish and see their little snout and their weird mouth and think, what do they eat? Are they just eating like plankton, zooplankton, copepods and stuff? These guys are cannibals, and they're predators. They're ambush predators. Yeah, they feed from the moment they're born on larval mosquito fish. Down in Costa Rica, they've done diet studies. They found them feeding on larval mojarra, a small silvery fish that's found everywhere. They eat crustaceans. They'll eat bug larvae. They're just out there feasting, which is pretty cool because when I saw them, I think, that's not a predatory fish. So then the juveniles will work their way back up to the stream, to freshwater. They'll enter the freshwater as a juvenile, mature. Now, the reason we kind of know this theory is that there have been, since the early 70s until the late 90s, every month, biweekly, surveys done in our area in saltwater eelgrass beds, out in the open ocean with larval trawls, in the freshwater, everywhere. And when we sample in the open ocean and in the saltwater eelgrass beds, we're only getting ever juveniles, never seeing an adult. And when we sample freshwater areas, we're only ever seeing adults. Also knowing that they could survive, reproduce, and repopulate in a landlocked style freshwater system, that's important to know. Now, if you were a fish that's been on this planet for 50 million years, you have to have a lot of strategies to survive. So if you were just stuck, like, I can only do freshwater, you ain't going to make it 50 million years. But the fact that we can do this many different ways is a true tale and a testament to how amazing this little guy is. Then they'll swim up, they'll come into the freshwater, they'll mature as adults. Thought process is also that when you go out into the ocean is similar to a desert. Not a lot of food, but also not a lot of predators per area, right? You come up into the freshwater, it's a little bit like a jungle. There's a ton of food here for you to mature, but there's also a lot of predators. So this life strategy also has aided them in having these reproducing populations. Being out in the ocean allows for drift, ensuring some genetic diversity.
I'm trying to imagine in my mind how these guys swim with their configuration. Could you just kind of describe what it looks like when they're swimming?
Yeah. So it's actually really cool. When you're thinking about the body of the opossum pipefish, you think, well, this little thing, if it was soft body, they wouldn't last too long. It'd be like a little gummy worm for all the other fish out there in the ocean and the river just gobbling them up. But they're protected by large articulating scales that form a ring around their body. And those rings go from the trunk to the tail. And if you want to think about it, the best way I could think is that it's kind of like armor. And each ring is not necessarily attached to the next ring, and it allows for articulation. So if you think about a medieval knight with all these big plates here and here and here, but he could still move because there was articulation in his body movement. So when you think about these pipefish, their movements are not these really serpent-like, slithering. They're not able to bend their bodies completely like that. They are not the best swimmers, but these guys having the pouch on their chest instead of their tail allows for a little more locomotion. They prefer slow-moving waters when swimming, and that's why the juveniles were going to go from their ocean phase and work their way up into the streams during our dry season. That's the time of lowest flow. And they can move from one little cluster of emergent vegetation to the next, little by little. Now, with that being said, something very cool about them is that they're resilient and persistent. There are known to be 3 metapopulations of this fish. They were found on the Western Atlantic, never in the Pacific, rarely, if ever, in the Gulf. So in 1913, 1914, they dug a Panama Canal. And when the Panama Canal was completed, opossum pipefish were found on the eastern terminus of the canal in the Pacific Ocean. And they have not been there before. They made it through 51 miles of canal, 12 locks. And that is also seen here in Florida in the St. Lucie River. They've made it up into Lake Okeechobee, which is a number of miles of canal with locks. And they've proven the ability to make it through locks, not necessarily water control structures. When a water control structure is open, its water is flowing out and flushing. When a lock opens up, it could slowly move in, let the door close behind it, and just wait its time. So although I say they aren't the best swimmers, the persistence and resilience of those little guys is amazing to make it through the Panama Canal. Are you kidding me?
So you've mentioned several times that these fish are resilient and they're versatile, but also you mentioned a number of changes to the freshwater habitats in Florida. I'm just curious because I know several species that when these changes happen, they're just not able to handle it. They see population declines. So has this fish been able to be resilient to those? How is it currently doing?
So currently, it's not doing great. It's still here, though, and it still has a breeding population in Florida. The number one threat is habitat loss. We have these little guys who live in our canals and our rivers are always associated with emergent vegetation, like panic grass or smartweed. What has been going away is our emergent vegetation. One, our wetlands are drained. People build houses. Development happens. Two, the rivers are just not the same as they were before. We have large trees overhanging the banks, shading out the banks, and kind of killing our emergent vegetation. And three, a lot of these canals and ditches I speak about that once were tropical rivers or tributaries are treated for stormwater control. When people treat a canal for stormwater control, they spray herbicides annually. So the herbicides are going to kill off all this emergent vegetation. Their stream banks and their canal banks are just devoid of all vegetation. And not only does it kill off the emergent vegetation, but it also kills off the algal mats, which form the base of the food web for these little ecosystems. Now, with that being said, we're still catching pipefish. We're not catching opossum pipefish in any way of the numbers that they did in the 50s, 60s, throughout the 90s. We are still collecting them. They are believed to only have a few hundred left within our Florida population, which is confined to the southern Indian River Lagoon. And that's the main reason that we're here and we've been working with these fish, is we do believe that with the right habitat, they would make a rebound. They've been putting up with a lot of stressors up till now. I mentioned habitat loss and habitat degradation. I didn't mention poor water quality, fish disease caused by algae blooms with the freshwater releases from Lake Okeechobee, or most recently that we're seeing is the non-native species. When Dr. Gilmore and Dr. Harrington and Dr. Carter did their original surveys, there was nothing but native species here. And recently, I surveyed a location where these guys had collected numerous pipefish. I did 100 yards and collected only jewel cichlids. An African cichlid, about 2 to 3, maybe 4 inches long under the right parameters. They are angry little fish. They will eat the fins off of a bass until it just can't perform its life and die. But we only caught jewelfish in 100 yards, over 200 jewelfish. So there are a lot of threats to this species. And like I mentioned, this is our poster child. There's a number of species that are native, have similar life histories, and live in the same water bodies as this guy. But we know if you protect one fish, you can protect all the fish. And most importantly, you protect the water the fish live in. And that's fresh water, which is going to be the most important thing us as humans need to have moving forward in our future, is good freshwater resources. So I think that paying attention to the fresh water and the things that live within it, we have a way to kind of like save ourselves in a way, right? In saving this fish, we're saving our health. You know, our habitats, our fun, our resource. People might not go fishing for this guy, but he's living alongside with 5 different species of snook that people do like to fish with. If we protect one, we protect them all. So yeah, guy, I did say they were resilient and I said they could swim across the Panama Canal, but they ain't doing too good right now.
Okay.
Hey, what are some things that folks can do? Are there some like calls to action? I know you mentioned herbicides. Are there some like actual things that people can focus on? You know, it seems like some of these issues are so big and you're like, oh, how am I gonna make a difference, but are there some things folks can do?
Well, there are, and you're right, Katrina, it's difficult. You know, it's even difficult for us. We're in it and you're looking like, oh man, what the heck can I even do? I'm just out here catching them, having the fun part, but what can we actually do to fix this? Through the work that we've done and the push by Dr. Gilmore, our local stormwater management district stopped spraying herbicides on a specific section of stream that is known to hold these fish and the other suite of fishes that I mentioned previously. And they stopped spraying herbicide and, you know, that emergent vegetation started to come back. One of our groups here, the Friends of the Sebastian River, they are working on helping to do habitat restoration and plantings in their areas. So although these big issues like human development, encroachment, and, you know, the Lake Okeechobee and freshwater releases, we're not changing that. And stormwater control, that's protecting people's houses, their livelihoods. I find that is very important. I don't want it to come across like I think the fish are more important. That's really important to make sure my house, my neighbor's house, everyone's house in our area doesn't get flooded. But in doing that, we can also protect these fish. Planting more emergent vegetation on our stream banks will slow down erosion, slow down the flow of water. We've heard this before with many different things. But what people could do is they could get out there and join their local groups. We have our Audubon Society, the Environmental Learning Center, and the Oxbow Learning Center, the Oxbow Eco Center, which are small environmental education organizations. They keep our fishes in tanks. They educate youth. They talk to people about what's there. We do the same with outreach and education. I know that's like beating it to death. Like, oh yeah, outreach and education. That's the answer to everything. But it is, because, you know, for everyone to know what's there, to love what's there, things will change. Also, you could do, if you live near a water body, you don't need to fertilize your lawn during the wet season. You can do it during the dry season. There's times for when to be a responsible human being, taking into account everything that lives around us on this earth. We're just one animal in this giant freaking ball of animals spinning in outer space. And the least we can do is take into account them as well as our neighbors and our friends. So a little bit of a mind change. That's what we can do, Katrina. And everyone has the control of that.
So you mentioned invasive species in the context of fishes. And you also mentioned the importance of emergent vegetation for this fish. I'm just curious what the emergent vegetation community looks like down there in Florida. Are you dealing with native plants? Are there a lot of invasive plants? Does that matter with respect to this fish?
Yeah, it does matter. When I mentioned before they spray herbicides, the herbicides are pest control. And we don't all think about plants as being pests, right? I think about pests maybe being like the little critter who got into your house and eating your cat food, or a bug or something like that. But the plants are pest control. And what happens is when we destroy our native in-stream population, the banks of our rivers and canals get covered with non-native plants and trees. I mentioned before about our rivers used to have really wonderful, like, littoral zone, bankside vegetation, but now we have a Brazilian pepper, which is a beautiful tree and attracts tons of bees and stuff, but it's a non-native plant that grows like crazy. So what that done is now on our riverbanks and shades out the stream, so we don't have the emergent vegetation. In our canals and ditches, we'll just have cogan grass and invasive grasses that cover the bankside and don't allow for any other grasses or emergent vegetation to grow. Now, the issue with these, if they grew in the water, maybe they would be good habitat for this pipefish, but they don't, and they outcompete the things that do. So they're just kind of taking over that boundary line. We do have a ton of non-native things. It's Florida, man. We got everything down here, and that's one of the reasons I love it. We talked before about like feeling like you were an explorer again and finding these weird little fish. Down here, you truly never know what you're going to get. And battling that balance between non-native and native fishes and plants and reptiles is really difficult. But I feel like it's something that people get on, you know, people could get behind, because everyone's kind of like fighting it too in their yard, like the air potato down here and all these different things that are taking over and itching on your skin. So we can all kind of, you know, get aboard the native train.
In terms of your office, I'm just curious, just real quick, maybe 30-second summary of what y'all do.
So we're here in central South Florida on the coast. We cover the peninsula of Florida, not the panhandle, from southeastern coastal Georgia down to the Florida Keys. My number one focus is the native fish work that we spoke about here. My one coworker, Cedric Doolittle, he's an amazing fish biologist, and he focuses in the Georgia area on Atlantic and short-nosed sturgeon recovery. We do a lot of work with Everglades restoration, and that's in the form of monitoring, mostly for invasive species. We're early detection invasive species. So we're out there looking for what's the next threat. How can we contain this threat? If we can't contain this threat, what do we know about its life history and what can we learn about it so we can protect our natural resources? There's a bunch of refuges in Florida, and they also are fish and wildlife. So we'll help out our refuges with their fisheries resources, which is mostly tied to recreation, something that we're all passionate about. The reason I'm a fish biologist is because I love eating fish, number one, and two, because I like catching them and seeing them. You know, we love the recreation part of things. And then we're down for whatever Florida. You know, we do work for invasive tegu trapping, which is a lizard. We're going to do anything we can to help. We do python surveys down in the Everglades. I caught one, only one. They're not as easy to find as the TV and the Instagram reels might make it seem. But like I said, my bread and butter is here on our native small body fishes, because that's where it's at.
What are some burning questions that still need to be answered about this fish, and what would need to happen to be able to answer those resource-wise or capacity-wise or anything like that?
Well, one of the real burning questions that I have is, what is the population size of these fish in our area? And from talking with researchers who have been working on fish in our area or these specific fish and other people, they've all found that it's going to be a really difficult task to actually determine the true population size of these fish in our area because of their larval disbursement and juvenile being dispersed into ocean and saline habitats, which are really difficult to sample because, you know, just how big and open they are, and focusing on only surveying and sampling adults within these degraded habitats. It's a very difficult ask, but I feel like with the appropriate manpower, womanpower, and the right technical gear, which we've been building upon, we will be able to answer that. Previously, these fish were only collected with seine nets and dip nets. If you're familiar with the fisheries field, you know that we electrofish everything there is because it's cool and fun and we don't really hurt things. But down here in our little canals that could be 2 inches deep one day and 3 feet deep the next day and are connected to the ocean, so have a really high conductivity, which is a limitation for electrofishing, we were unable to use that technique. But we took some techniques from what people would do in the north, stream barges for trout and salmon and whatnot. We built our own stream barge down here, but we put the most powerful generator we could fit on it. And we're able to electrofish in conductivities that are 10 times, 100 times as much as what people do electrofish for. So what we've been able to see is better representation of communities. Now, we've only been doing this for a few years that we really got into this work. And it's difficult because, like I mentioned, you might go out today and say, oh, that canal is perfect to go in. It's 12 inches deep, and come back tomorrow. And they got the gates open and it's flooded, or they close the gates and it's really shallow. Coming up with alternative sampling techniques, but not ignoring the ones of the past, the seine nets and the dip nets are really important. Dr. Gilmore has a data set that goes for about 10 years from 1972, I believe, to 82 of monthly collections of pipefish in the same area every month for 10 years. So what we're working to is to couple our new electrofishing efforts with a recreation of his original study, revisiting his spots with his equipment once a month throughout the year. So we can have comparative studies. If we can't get a real grasp of the whole population, we can get a good grasp on the trends. So we can do comparative studies, and then we can use the new gear that we're developing to help us really better understand the communities. Because with the same net, you're really not going to get the jewelfish. You're not going to get a lot of the invasives or the faster moving fish. So you would get maybe a poor picture of what's really happening. Another burning question that I have, I just want to know more and more about them. I mentioned before, like, why would pipefish switch from having the chest pouch to the tail pouch? And everyone's like, oh, I don't know. So I feel like there's a lot of things that need to be known. In, I think it was 1991, NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric, and that one's a mouthful, administration, they recommended that this fish be listed for protections. So that was 1991. It's 2024, you know, and the same
2025.
It's 2025. It's, geez, it's going to be 2026 before we end this. But they listed, they recommended that these fish have protections. But what happened was people don't really know about it. Even the prominent biologists in our field here, They call them a marine invader, whatever that means. This is a freshwater fish that spends part of its time in salt water as a juvenile and comes back into freshwater. So there was jurisdictional issues. Like, well, whose fish is it? You know, there was issues. Is it a marine fish? Is it a freshwater fish? And then there was just too much unknowns that that recommendation got pushed to the side. They never got listed for protections. Now, like I said, 1991, it was in the 90s to 2025. Like, that's a long time.
Long time.
And speaks to the resiliency guy, the resiliency, because things were going bad in 1991, but these guys are still here just waiting for their opportunity. Like I said before, if you're going to be on this planet for 50 million years, you got to be able to survive. These guys are survivors. So those are two of my real burning questions. I also want to work on an occupancy study. I want to do some work on habitat suitability index for where these fish live, what they associate with now. Could they prefer non-native plants? We don't know. Is there a possibility that now they associate with a non-native emergent vegetation? Guy, that was a good point. And that leads me to think that that habitat suitability, which is when you're catching fish, finding out which habitat they associate with, that would be something that is maybe a little easier for me to handle and something we can get done.
I'm glad you touched on the field work, because I was definitely going to ask you about that. And I'm curious what it looks like when a pipefish rolls over from electrofishing, or if they are affected by it at all. Because my only experience with them, it was actually, and this kind of echoes your point about exploration, and I helped teach this course with UGA. It's a Fishes of Georgia field course. And we have this 1 week where we're down on Saplow Island, and me and the other like TA guy, we were trying to catch 50 fish that year. And so we had to pull out all the stops, all the sampling methods, all the habitats. And we ended up getting 3 species of pipefish. But the only way I could do it was like wading through like basically waist deep, chest deep water and getting a big dip net full of mud. Then I saw a pipefish in there. I went over to the hose and just washed it off. This is in kind of like these tidal stream areas. And it was the most exciting thing probably from the whole trip. It was like, I didn't even know we had pipefish here in this grass. It was fantastic. But I'd be curious to hear what it's like to electrofish with them. And then also, if just to tack on a secondary question, do you recall the first time you ever saw one of these pipefish?
Oh, yeah, I do. Well, we'll start with the electrofishing part. I definitely remember it. So the cool thing is, like the field work portion of it, I mentioned 2 things, right? We have our historical type of field work, which is with seines and dip nets. Now, that's fun because you need 3 people to seine for pipefish. And the reason is very specific is we're not just like pulling a seine through the whole canal, because we know where they live. They live in vegetation. You know, they're ambush predators that live in vegetation. They camouflage with the vegetation. They stand up straight and pretend like they're a little stick within the sticks, like I said. So what you would do is you would go to the clumps of emergent vegetation, kind of surround it with the seine net, and then someone goes behind it, stomping. I know it's like the real, like the most primitive way to catch it, but stomping on the bank and then stomp a little like in the thing, and they'll swim out of the vegetation into the seine net, and then you just kind of scoop it up. And that was found to be the most effective way of saying that. Now, when you electrofish, we're not just looking for pipefish, obviously, right? We're trying to get an idea of the whole community and what's going on there. And these guys have such a small body that there's limited surface area to kind of accept that electric shock, right? And they're living within this freaking clump of emergent vegetation. We had to kind of adjust the way we do things, which is the way, you know, you're going to learn along the way sampling any new species. Is that when we come upon emergent vegetation, I'll stick my wand out and I will shock around the vegetation. My initial idea is that in the middle of that plant, the pipefish is like, oh, you know, and then he's just stuck there in the plant. So we're not going to see him. Take my finger off the trigger, the electricity stops, and they'll swim out. And then I hit them again. And then they go, oh, and they go like the stick, like I said, and then we'll scoop them up in the net. So if you only went with an initial shock, you're not going to see them. And we've tested this. And I said, all right, 1 time, no. 2 times, oh, now we'll get them. And then I hesitate to kind of go back in there and just stab around with electricity the whole time, because part of the goal is not to harm fish as much as it is to see them. But then I'll have someone come behind with a dip net and just kind of poke around at the vegetation just to make sure that we didn't miss anything. And when you do that multiple pass, like little electric style, we don't miss anything. We get it all, even the little prawns, the shrimp. There's so much cool stuff down here. you guys were up there trying to catch 50 fish. I imagine you meant 50 species, correct, guy?
Yes, yeah, sorry. 50 no, fishes.
No, I knew what you meant. If you only were going to get 50 fish in a whole summer, that would be weird. But 50 species, we'll go out into the canal here and get 30 species in a day. And by a day, I mean a couple hours. The diversity down here is just incredible. And every day I'm learning something new. You should see my little backpack of like keys that I've made to get through the different species of 7 species of Mahara and 5 species of snook and 6 species of river prawn. And, you know, it's just amazing. And then I'll go back to the first time that I ever saw one of these pipefish. I first got my job here with the Peninsula Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. And at that time, we were going out with seine nets, just kind of assisting local researchers, maybe twice a year or something like that. And every time we went, we didn't get anything. And it was a little depressing for me. I was like, oh, man, what the heck are we even doing? Like, I'm not even seeing these fish. Are they gone? You know, because the stories that the researchers are kicking to me, some doom and gloom scenarios. So I'm like, oh, man, these things are gone forever. But then we went out on our own and we're more intensive in our search. And me and my partner here, Cedric, were going at every plant bed we could find. And I saw what looked like a wet stick in my net and went to grab it. And I was going to, like, toss it out of the net, because that wasn't it, obviously. That was the wet stick. And when I picked it up in my fingers, it wriggled around like it was, oh, my God, the ability for it to wriggle around its body in my hand. And I was like, oh, my God, Cedric. I didn't put it in my mouth to see if it clicks. I set it down in my hand, and it wriggled around. We measured it. It was a male, evidence of the pouch. It wasn't really colored up. It was in the winter, but it did have some red coloration. And then I put my hand underwater and waited for it to swim off of my hand and swim away. Because it was like, I don't know, a dozen times I went out and didn't see one. And I was getting really like down. You know, I really want to help these fish, but how can we help them if we can't even find them? You know? And then here we were, we found one. And it gave me like ultimate energy to get out there and just crush it. And then we built the electroshocker barge. And now, pipefish, beware, we're coming for you.
Yeah, I wish we were on video. You guys should see Eddie, who's just like getting all excited.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I get it. Oh, man. You know, Katrina, I love this stuff. And I love the fish, especially, I'm going to say it again, the ones that are little and don't have a voice for themselves. That's what I feel like my job here on this planet is, to speak for them. And if we can help save these little guys, like I said, we can save a lot of things.
You're doing a great job.
Nice. I wish everyone was as passionate about their work as you are.
One final challenge for you, Eddie. You got a 30-second elevator speech on just summarizing why this fish is cool. You're telling someone really important about it and why should people care.
All right. Well, I find the opossum pipefish cool for many reasons. But something that blows my mind is the length of time that this fish has been on our planet. He's the granddaddy of all pipefish and seahorses. It's the link that we have with the history that has become what our planet is today. Not only is it a cool fish, it's a unique fish, it's got a cool body, it's colorful and all that stuff, but losing a link that has been on our planet for as long as it has would be a catastrophe. Now, the most important reason we need to protect the opossum pipefish is to protect all the freshwater fish. I don't think the opossum pipefish is better than or should be protected more than the river goby, the big mouth sleeper, the white mouth croaker, the burrow grunt, the slash-cheek goby. I could go on forever. These are all fish that have the similar lifestyle, live in the similar water bodies as this fish. We protect one of them, we can protect all of them. Biodiversity is important. It aids us in our value to our sport fishes, the ones we find important. It aids us in so many ways, and it keeps our ecosystems intact and connected and beautiful. We protect these fish, we protect all the fish around them, and you protect the water that they live in. This is the water that we need to live and to survive. Now, if we're going to look past all these like big, serious things that I talk about why we should protect them, it's because the thing is the cutest fish on the planet. It's got a red snout and a red tail, and it clicks when it mates. It's amazing. I don't know, Katrina. I just think that they're all amazing. I mean, I can do the same talk and tell you why we need to protect the other fish I mentioned, the fat sleeper, the big mouth sleeper, the river goby. Another one, the river goby. It's the ancestral grandfather to the gobies, and it lives side by side with this guy. They live in the same streams. We catch them all the time. It's an amazing thing. Anyway, I think protecting these fish will protect the little like explorer within all of us, being able to really, like I said, guy, dig down, and find these little things and feel like you discovered something, although someone already did, that's amazing to me. And what that brings is energy for me to keep doing what I'm doing, not only to protect fish, but to live my life, like my personal life too, to have fun, to go home, to be happy, you know, because I'm finding excitement in the everyday. I allow myself to be excited by life every day. I think we all should. And this fish excites me. And that's why it should be protected.
Perfect.
Awesome. Any for president. Well, get out there and live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially the opossum pipefish. And Eddie, we're going to have you back and talk about some hog chokers and maybe folks listening. If you have some fish that Eddie mentioned today that you want to hear about, reach out and let us know. That was super fun. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much for giving me a little space here to talk about this fish who can't talk for themselves. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Arrow. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, commonly known as ICE, arrested a Philippine national in Kodiak, according to a post on X last week. KMXT could not confirm his immigration status or if this was the only arrest made during the agency's visit to the island. Both Alaska State Troopers and Kodiak Police say ICE did not request any assistance for the arrest. The city's police chief, Tim Putney, says that's normal when federal agencies plan arrests on the island.
There are times they might need a patrol car to transport somebody, but normally they take care of all their logistics, so to speak, the paperwork and conducting the arrest.
ICE presence is unusual for Kodiak, though, and comes as the Trump administration has ramped up deportation activities. The agency also arrested a Mexican citizen in Sitka last month. ICE posted on X that the Kodiak man was picked up over a previous conviction for sexual assault of a minor. According to court documents, he pleaded guilty after felony charges were filed in 2017. Margaret Stock, an Anchorage-based attorney and expert on immigration law, says it's hard to get exact information about his particular case, but she says individuals picked up in these circumstances still have a right to a hearing with a judge and hire an attorney. Serious crimes are still a deportable offense, even for legal immigrants.
So ordinarily when somebody gets charged with a crime in Alaska, after they finish their criminal case and they get out of criminal custody, at that point immigration steps in and tries to do the immigration court case, which is a civil matter.
The man is currently being detained at the Anchorage Correctional Complex, according to ICE's website. Alaska's voter-approved mandate for paid sick leave has not yet gone into effect, but some lawmakers are already trying to reduce the number of workers who would benefit from it. The Alaska Beacon reports a bill pending in the Alaska legislature would exempt businesses with fewer than 50 employees, a change from the 15-employee threshold in the labor rights initiative that voters approved in November. The bill would also drop seasonal workers from the mandate for accrued paid sick leave. It addresses ballot measure 1, a three-part citizen initiative that will raise Alaska's minimum wage and protect workers against any employer-imposed political or religious meetings, as well as mandate paid sick leave based on time accrued over work periods. Voters approved ballot measure 1, and the new law is set to go into effect on July 1st. The bill has the enthusiastic backing of the Alaska Chamber, a business group that campaigned against the ballot measure. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
North Rim Bank, helping power the businesses that power Alaska with customized solutions. More at northrim.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed an increase to school funding Thursday, saying the bill was too expensive and didn't include policies that he says would bolster school choice and improve student performance. Instead, he proposed a smaller funding package for schools. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone spent hours on the phone talking with the people who lead school districts at the center of this debate. Here's what they had to say.
There were some themes.
My reaction was, once again, disappointment.
I think frustration is the word I'm going to choose here.
Frustrating and a little bit confusing.
It's our students that are going to lose out.
Those are voices from across the state. Superintendent Kim Hanisch in Unalaska, Ketchikan High School Principal Rick Dormer, Anchorage School Board President Andy Holloman, and the head of the Northwest Arctic Borough School District, Terry Walker. Walker leads a district based in Kotzebue with 12 schools spread out over a land area about the size of Virginia. She says each of those schools is the center of a community.
Everything happens in that building. Weddings and funerals and meetings, because it is the only largest place for gathering for the whole community. Oftentimes, many of the villages have catastrophes, floods, the electricity goes out, their housing freezes up, and the school is a safe place to go.
And she says her school's ability to keep that up is at risk. Schools have gotten infusions of one-time funding in recent years as lawmakers and the governor have failed to come to terms on a long-term funding boost. But she says costs keep going up, and she's looking at deep cuts to core programs, student activities, even second helpings at meals for hungry students.
We are really cut to the bare bones right now, chipping at the bones, actually.
So Walker is disappointed that the governor vetoed a bill that would boost basic per-student funding, the base student allocation, by $1,000. And she says the $560 increase Dunleavy is proposing instead won't stop the bleeding.
That does not cover half of the deficit that we are looking at.
Now, the governor isn't just proposing $560 in basic funding. He's also proposing $35 million in what he calls targeted funding. That's an increase in formula funding for homeschool, plus an incentive program that would provide a boost for each young student who performs well on literacy assessments. Dunleavy is pitching the total package as equivalent to a $700 base student allocation increase. But school leaders like Deidre Jensen, the superintendent in Sitka, say that leaves them with a lot of questions.
Does that mean that we're going to get it before him because we've had good scores, because we've shown growth? Well, what does it mean for the ones that have been doing all these cuts and they're not making as good growth? Like, what does it mean?
Another question, where do we go from here? That's the mood. Uncertainty. Structural uncertainty because of the timeline on which the state funds education. Uncertainty because nobody's sure where the political football will land. Rick Dormer, the principal of Ketchikan High School, says he's worked in the private sector for Hewlett-Packard and Nike.
None of them run a business like this. So, and they make shoes. Those are dead, inanimate objects. We're working with people's children. I have children in Alaskan schools today. Like, I want them to explain why this is an okay business model and a funding model for people's children.
Dormer says he wants lawmakers and the governor to work together to figure out something. That was another theme I heard a lot in my conversations with school leaders from Ketchikan to Kotzebue. They want to see the state's elected leaders come up with a compromise that keeps schools functioning. Whether they will in the next 30 or so days before the legislative session ends, well, we'll have to see. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
This is Alaska Public Media.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring. When the little bluebell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work starts a tune to the moon up above. It is nature, that's all, simply telling us to fall in love. And that's why birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it. Live Iranians and let's do it, let's do it, let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns. Folks in Siam do it, think of Siamese twins. Some Argentines without means do it. People say in Boston even beans do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay, do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams, gainst their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it, though it shocks them, I know. Why ask if shad do it? Waiter, bring me shad roe. In shallow shoals, English souls do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love.
Good morning, everybody out here in paradise. Hope you had a great day for Easter yesterday. And our Pope has passed away. That's big news. And I don't know what else is happening in the world. Raining a little bit here. Anyway, we're almost to the top of the hour. Play a little Bill Anderson with Mr. Peepers, and that'll take us to the top of the hour.
As she rode in the car behind a black limousine, she thought about the man she'd known since she was 17. She was glad he was gone, and soon she would forget she was married to the dullest man she had ever met. He never was the kind of man she wanted him to be. They never had that big white house or raised a family. And she called him Mr. Peepers, just a shy, quiet man. She never took time to believe in him or try to understand. And as she gave his dying soul to the preacher man to say, one by one a crowd began to gather around his grave. 44 weeping stewardesses with children kneeling down, and each one looked just like the man they were laying in the ground. 23 fashion models and a girl he called his niece, with a disco dancing trophy in the name of the deceased. 17 Playboy bunnies and his next door neighbor's wife, they say she caused his heart to quit the night he lost his life. Old Spencer Brown, from a secret rendezvous, she came to say goodbye to the only man she ever knew. And she called him Mr. Peepers, just a shy, quiet man. She never took time to believe in him or try to understand. And as she gave his dying soul to the preacher man to say, one by one a crowd began to gather around his grave. 44 weeping stewardesses with children kneeling down, and each one looked just like the man they were laying in the ground. 23 fashion models and a girl he called his niece, with a disco dancing trophy in the name of the deceased. 17 Playboy bunnies,
and she called him Mr. Peepers.
And she thought he was gone. He had a closet big as a warehouse, and they all came out. 22 secretaries, 13 cocktail waitresses, One disc jockey, a broadcast personality. Two truck drivers, and I'm going to tell you, those were the ugliest two women you ever laid your eyes on. Dull, friends, is in the eye.